folks, and welcome back to Clay Commons, a podcast about community ceramics and clay as a force for good. So far, we've heard about the decline of HE ceramic courses and how open studios are creating new models for education, fostering community, and questioning what role these spaces and artists have in society. In this episode, we're speaking to artists working closely with dementia patients, people with learning disabilities, and generally asking what happens in our brains when we touch and use clay. So, let's get into it. As we discussed in episode 2, many of the independent community ceramic spaces in the UK prescribed to some form of open studio model and grew from a need identified by artists to create spaces to facilitate their own work and that of other professionals and to provide learning opportunities for the wider, mostly paying public. It's proved incredibly successful, and although we only heard from two of these spaces, there's studios literally all over the UK, from Hastings to Newcastle. While there's a definite social awareness that comes with these studios, their business model means that the outreach aspects often seem to be an important byproduct rather than a central goal, at least at their outset. However, the beauty of these spaces is that they are small and therefore flexible enough to respond to the needs of their community. For example, I spoke to several spaces that became food banks during the first COVID lockdown and sent out art packs to their local community to support children and adults in isolation. In this episode, we're looking at a different form of engagement, one that centralises well-being, health and community support. Artist Bridget Connolly has been working with clay for over 20 years since the early 2000s, where she retrained from linguist to ceramicist and started teaching in prisons. She's since gone on to specialise in teaching people with severe mental health issues.
I started working in prison. I was about halfway through doing my PhD. I was doing 3 days a week. It just made me realise the basic sort of unquantifiable preciousness of making with someone. And it's not about, can I sell this? Does anyone know who I am? It's just about, what am I getting at this moment in time? And it sort of really throws the rest of the kind of monetized capitalist aspect of the art world into relief quite strongly. And you kind of think, well, what's that about? When I was really young, I worked in Brixton Prison and taught English for a few years because I was always more interested in sort of less conventional educational settings. I was finding people who couldn't operate within a prison system and because they lacked language and trying to find ways that they could begin to realise where they were and learn how to get what they needed.
Sorry, when you say they sort of were lacking language, are you talking like English wasn't their first language or they were having...
Yes, exactly. They had real trouble. While I was doing my PhD, I was doing it part-time. I think I really, really was looking for another space of working, which wasn't about academic work, which was about being with people and making. And a job came up in the mental health assessment unit in Holloway Prison, working with women, which was something I would always really wanted to do, particularly mental health. So I just started doing that 3 days a week. And I would have carried on because it was such interesting work. But then the government closed the prisons, which was a tragedy, really.
Could I pause you there for a second and just ask you a little bit about... Because I think it's really interesting. It doesn't sound to me like you had any kind of specific arts therapy training. You didn't sort of start off as a sort of social worker or anything like that. So I just wondered what you, if you had any kind of thoughts or about, I guess, the sort of difficulties and the, just generally the sort of the idea of as a sort of essentially untrained young artist going into these spaces, especially in terms of the sort of maybe the prison situation and like the sort of clashes of that, because I'm seeing a lot more people, like artists, kind of basically being put in front of or put up as alternatives to kind of frontline care. I know there's something really useful and really integral that we can bring to those spaces, but I just wondered if you could, yeah, just talk a little bit more about that, because it's quite a problematic idea, really, isn't it?
Yeah. It really is very problematic, particularly if you have no support as an artist being put into that situation. In Holloway, I was, so it was part of an occupational therapy program. We organised craft and ceramics, but, you know, we were working with an occupational therapist who trained as an artist. She was very keen to have art that wasn't just about therapy. In Holloway, there were lots of therapists, psychologists, who could provide that form of therapy. And there were art therapists as well. But I think it's also really important to have somebody working with people when they're making art who is an artist, who values the person as a creative, who isn't seeing it as, you know, something else. And I think that's invaluable, actually, that just the fact that when you are making, somebody is able to, you know, make them feel secure in that moment, but you're valuing what they do in a different way.
It's sort of identity building, I guess, isn't it?
It is very much identity building. And I think lots of people I work with said they quite liked it that you weren't a therapist, that you weren't trying to read what they were doing as a way of trying to understand them as in a kind of professional way. Not that that isn't important. I think it is, obviously. But I just think it's really nice to have that other aspect.
I wanted to highlight what Bridget just touched on around supporting artists working with vulnerable communities. Artists are fluid creatures that respond to the world around them. So in my mind, it makes sense that there's been a definite rise in socially conscious art or socially engaged art over the last few years, which could easily be said to be in response to the increasing challenges we face as a society. Recession, climate emergency, failing social care, racism, and all the other isms that dominate our world. Anecdotally, I've seen many artists work with communities around these subjects really successfully. But this kind of work often works best when it's done in collaboration with other sectors, with professionals and community workers who understand the needs of their community. Artists aren't therapists or social workers, although some may be that as well. But we do have something great to offer, the creation of space for different ways of thinking and exploring your whole self through creativity. And when this is facilitated with the correct support from other professionals, great things can happen. Someone who knows all about the value of being an artist in the field of social work is Jana Edwards from 15 Days of Clay in Holton Lee near Poole in the south of England. Her studio was originally set up as a 15-day experiment providing clay workshops for people with learning disabilities. The fact that it's still thriving 17 years later is testament to her incredible energy and commitment to providing professional level teaching to groups that are often dismissed or sidelined by society and traditional teaching spaces.
For me, with like 15 days, I mean, when I first set 15 days up, that actually it was quite a groundbreaking project because, say, if you had a learning difficulty, you went to a day centre. There wasn't sort of these external groups run independently at that time. So I was pretty much the first. So social services took quite a gamble on me and very much were like, okay, you just need to be sustainable. And obviously, you know, 17 years later, I think I've proved that point. Yeah. But I think also that there's, with the whole community element, I think it's about bringing people together into a space that is theirs. That's something that I think is really important. I mean, we're very fortunate where we're based, Holton Lee, that, you know, we're set in like 350 acres of beautiful countryside. So literally our studio looks out onto fields. Amazing. So as soon as you actually enter that space, you literally come down the driveway and you just feel the weight of the world kind of slip off. And obviously the space that we work in is, it's the artist's space. It's your space. You're responsible for it. And it's, you know, it's a space where you can be yourself. And I think this whole idea of coming together as a community of like-minded people where you can be comfortable, you can be yourself, where there's no fear, where, you know, you're enabled to have confidence. And if you're having a bad day, it's okay. We all have bad days. I think sort of what we've created at 15 Days has been a real battle to get to it initially, because at the start, very much, I think, you know, going back sort of 17 years, anything sort of creative, a lot of people would be like, well, what do? They just play around with clay. Actually, we do an awful lot. So it's taken many years to get the recognition of what we do seen. I very much play the political game. So when we have exhibitions, I would invite the mayor. I would invite the head of so-and-so. I would force them into that situation of seeing what we do. And then thus, obviously, having exhibitions, reaching the wider community, the public, to also then let them see what people can achieve. And I think very much to start with, because of the groups that I was working with, people with disabilities, there was a mindset of, you know, people with disabilities can't do this, can't do that. Well, actually, this is about the ability So the disability is not the concern at all. And I think, you know, this is bringing people together into a space where instead of, I can't do this, I can't do that, I can. We enable people to achieve, and that's so important. And they live in a world where actually they're told often or not, you can't do this, you're not good enough for that, or you couldn't possibly do this. Well, actually you can. And, you know, if you're struggling, we'll find a way. I know for sort of on the well-being side, there's a lot of people that sort of just from coming, their communication skills have improved, confidence levels improved, people that came with 3-to-1 support, that came with no support, people, you know, that on physical benefits couldn't open their hands, you know, it was constantly in a fist. And from literally using the rolling pin and manipulating the clay, they now move their hands. People that have mental health issues that have come off medication. It's an enormous impact that this has had. And one I had no idea would ever happen. You know, I'm not a therapist. I just wanted to enable people that weren't able to access clay to access clay and be taught by, you know, professional artists to the highest standard. You know, you and I go off to college.
Yeah.
Where can a lot of the guys that I work with, where can they go to actually be given the option and support to achieve? There's not many places, you know, and I know now there is, but at that time there wasn't.
Jana goes on to explain why she feels the space has been so successful and how her role as an artist and highly trained ceramicist has added to the ethos of the studio.
This sort of idea that artists are kind of put in front of or instead of frontline services, that you're kind of just pushed in front of like, okay, well, you can fix that problem. Like, have you kind of come across that? Why did you think there was a need for it? You know, how did you kind of become aware of that?
I think what's happened over the years, initially, it was absolutely just about ceramics. And I think what's become very clear, I am now social worker, parent, you know, the lioness, the tiger that goes after people's battles. And if people have issues that are going on externally, you know, often they'll come to 15 days to meet the person because it's a safe space.
Yeah.
I did some care work when I first moved here to learn a lot more about the client group. And there's a lot of caring that comes in to my roles. I've become very emotionally involved with, you know, everybody that comes and their families. So, you know, rightly or wrongly, that's how I think it's survived and is so well supported and loved, is because, you know, I've had to adapt. I've had to learn running different situations. I've had to learn about sort of systems. You know, you might have somebody that just turns up and they've had their medication change, but no one tells you. Some of the things I've seen over the years have been very upsetting, very frustrating. And I mustn't become cynical, kind of constantly like, right, don't let the system beat you. I'm very stubborn and I don't take no for an answer. If someone says no, I'm like, right, we'll find a way. And if somebody comes to me and says, Jana, I've got problems with X, Y, Z, can you help? I help. I think that's the difference. You're not going to get that in other places. But what comes with that is we're all very close knit. We're very supportive of each other. That is a real blessing to work in an environment like that. And when you're working collaboratively together, I mean, we had our big 15 years of 15 days in clay show at the Lighthouse in Poole, where we built 15 life-size figures to represent one from every year that we've run. The figures were built in like 3 sections. So it was like 45 bits of huge ceramic as a collective. And I purposely didn't tell the other person. So you had like a bottom, a middle and a head. And I purposely didn't tell each artist what the bottom or the middle or the head looked like. You know, there's that game, isn't there, where you draw, you fold the paper.
Thing,
Yeah, real gamble, but amazing. And it worked so beautifully and everybody just so came together. When you stood back and you kind of looked, everybody just beavering away. And then when you saw everyone's faces for the first time when they came in and saw the show, because they hadn't seen the work up or even together. And it was, it was really emotional. Yeah. The private view, everyone was crying. It was just such a powerful presence to these works, and it encapsulated just how powerful as a collective we are and just how incredible, you know, each of us are. And that really came across and, you know, that was personified in play, us.
Jana also speaks about the importance of not only making people feel special, but also how quality can play a role in the experience in nurturing confidence and independence in her students.
How we work at 15 Days is that we treat people as people. People that I know that run other organisations, and they're like, how do you get so-and-so to actually do anything? Because when they come to me, they sit there and they won't do anything. And I'm just like, we speak to them as a human. Yeah. It's not rocket science. I found out when I was 40, when I was doing my MA, that I was dyslexic. Right. And I've always known, I've thought in a, with Jana's way. And to me, that was my way. And it was only sort of being taken out of my natural environment, and unbeknown to me, all these safety triggers I'd created, that my brain went haywire.
Yeah.
And so the way that I learn, I teach in that way. So there is no wrong. Let's simplify. That's how I think anyway. So it's quite normal. And I know when someone tries to teach me something, if they do it in a certain way, my brain goes and shakes. So I think because of that experience, unbeknown to me, that's something very natural. You know, I'm constantly looking at someone's face, looking for any pain there or anxiety or stress or anything. So, okay, you know, so I can then try another way. And that for me, I find that side fascinating because you can reach everybody. I love trying to problem solve to try and find a way. And then when you sit back and you see that person achieve, it's just, wow, it's amazing. It's not rocket science. It's just be patient and give them respect, and it works.
This idea of high creative standard and that idea of professional practice, regardless of who you are, and holding people to a standard, I think is really interesting. Like, again, like you say, it feels so obvious, but actually people don't do it. It's just like, oh, well, yeah, you know, you're disabled, that'll do. No, like expecting more of people.
You know, it's like the finish of a piece, or, you know, a finish of a piece is everything. I'll be going, no, come on, please try a bit more, a bit more. Oh, it's like, I know, and you know, at the end of the day, that the finish is everything. Mm-hmm. And it's like, is that really joined properly? Is it?
Yeah.
Or, you know, or same thing. Okay, sometimes things go wrong. And they break or they blow up or crack. So it's life.
Yeah.
We'll move on. And I think that's so important. And things down to, you know how to make your own slip, off you go. You know how to make it, off you go. It's your studio. Mm-hmm. It's not me standing there telling you what to do or babysitting you. This is your space. You're the artist making your work, your choice. And that's massive. You are involved in all aspects. You clean your tools at the end. I'm not. Yeah. You clean up. You're responsible. This is your work. This is important. Mm. And I think also the way we teach as well, somebody might say, right, I'm going to make so-and-so. And then I'll say, how big? And they'll go, ah, you know, about 6 foot something. And I go, okay, we'll find a way. I don't think there's ever been anything that somebody has suggested that I've gone, no. Mm. I think the only time will be if someone picks something, it will be just another bowl. And I'm like, no, challenge yourself more. And they'll laugh and go, oh, yeah, it's all right. Okay. But I think, again, that's the beautiful thing. You decide. So the only limitation is my back. But that's it.
This idea of treating and speaking to people as humans seems like an obvious one. But unfortunately, I don't think it's always the baseline it should be, especially in a society that seems more focused on economic growth for a few over thriving communities for all. Helen Lee, one-time therapist, now full-time ceramicist with an interest in neuroscience, because why not, talks about her experiences with the Wednesday Wanderers, a walking dementia group in Cornwall, and the four things that identify us as who we are.
You mentioned sort of rehumanising us, and I think the Wednesday Wanderers absolutely do that at a very sort of normal level. You know, we're toolmakers. We use our hands to manipulate the world in the way that no other species does. Obviously, a few do it a little bit, and it's utterly fascinating, but we do it to an extent which is quite extraordinary. We're also relationship navigators, I call it. We're designed to operate in a group, possibly originally of about 150, and those relationships were crucial to survival. So if you were outside the group, you died. So we learn all these different ways of navigating relationships. And I think relationships are the most complex thing we do by an absolute mile. So there's that to sort of factor in. But we were developed in nature, right? We weren't designed for a global digital world. We've adapted because we're probably also two of the most adaptable species. Well, definitely. We can live anywhere, achieve anything. It's quite phenomenal. And also the other thing we need is meaning. You know, we're meaning makers, storytellers, and we can't function without that meaning. We just sort of disappear, really. These are all the things that are massively impacted, obviously, by dementia as the brain is affected. So you're sort of acutely aware of the four things that identify as who we are. And interestingly, we don't ask the question ever, what do we need to operate well? You know, that's the question that goes unasked. It's all about money and economy and who's got the most power and the most money.
My grandma had dementia, and it's a really horrible disease watching someone you love disappear. Anyone who's been through that with a loved one knows how exhausting and isolating this can be, both for those with dementia and their carers. Katie Spragg is a good friend and artist whose central practice involves botanical porcelain sculpture, but who also sees teaching and clay engagement as an important part of her artistic identity. She helped develop a six-week clay and dementia program at the Garden Museum in London, which has been running for the last 4 years. Here she is speaking with Garden Museum Engagement Officer Janine Nelson about how they've created support and community through their clay programming.
So I was thinking about the type of people that we first had come. And because we ran the first sessions with the Arts for Dementia charity, we actually kind of inherited a few of their participants who I think were used to going to activities and were used to kind of working in groups with people. And I think, although not all our participants came from that background, because some of them did, that was really helpful in them sort of being familiar with that idea of working together. And something we haven't mentioned that is probably quite important to the way we run the sessions is that we say that the sessions are for people affected by dementia. So the person with dementia comes with a companion, and that might be their partner, it might be one of their children, it might be a paid for carer. And they are just as important as the people with dementia. And some of them have continued to attend the sessions after their partner with dementia might have passed away. And that's a really important part of what we do.
Yeah, that's really important. And it came from Arts for Dementia, didn't it? It was part of their rules for the pilot that we did with them. They couldn't come alone. They had to come with somebody. Although we did have somebody who did come alone for a while, and he would end up on a bus somewhere else. And we had fun games there. So they couldn't come alone, they had to come with somebody else, so they had the support of somebody else with them. But also that person had to join in, they couldn't just sit there being passive, and that they both had to be treated equally. So I think that has worked really, really well. So that wasn't our idea.
Yeah, and I think actually we've probably seen some partners coming who they're maybe used to the thing of like, oh, they come and they just sit with their partner and they don't do the activity and were maybe quite hesitant at the beginning. And then we've been not pushy, but we've really encouraged them to like, oh, just give it a go. Here, we'll just give you a piece of clay, and seen those people who thought that this activity wasn't for them and they didn't want to engage also get really into it and really involved. And although they're still supporting the person with dementia, you can kind of see that it's a bit of a break and a bit of respite kind of into their own mind and being able to be creative for that hour or so that we're working.
And getting to meet other people, they form support networks themselves that exist outside of Clay for Dementia, and they have discussions about all sorts of things which, you know, we're not necessarily party to, but they're become a support network.
Yeah, because we've heard feedback that other classes, it's like once the person with dementia is gone, the person who's left behind almost isn't welcome at those sessions anymore. And we absolutely wanted to maintain this sort of welcoming space for people to come to for as long as they want. And Janine talked before a bit about how we welcome kind of family members to the sessions, particularly at the beginning. And now we're sort of having this view into people's homes. There's this lovely quality that we've seen their grandchildren grow up. There's one person whose lodger came to one of our sessions, and we can hear him working from home on the other side of the table while she's doing clay. To be able to have that insight and that kind of knowledge of the people we work with feels like that's like an extra layer of support that we can offer. Being able to kind of say hello to their grandchildren that are running past in the background, or kind of acknowledge the people that are around them.
Katie's referring to moving their programming online during COVID and the wonderful, unexpected window into people's lives and families that that afforded them. As we start to move back into the real world, anyone working with community will also tell you how important it is to create space where everyone can feel comfortable and welcome. And whilst I'm not saying that clay can cure dementia, unfortunately, of course not, what I got from both Katie and Janine was a real sense that although we're all on a one-way path, what they've witnessed is that there can still be joy and even new learning along the way.
We had Tom, who passed away last year, making amazing things the further down the line he got, but he didn't appreciate them as amazing. It was just everybody around him looking at what he did. Well, Katie and I in particular. And I think that's quite an interesting thing as well, that the people that are making them don't necessarily always see the work the way that we see it.
We haven't actually spoken about that. I know Katie's sort of come into the studio previously and been like, they're getting better. Like, how is this possible? Because all of the conversations around dementia is that you can only get worse. And actually, they're learning really quite refined cognitive skills and retaining that information. It'd be really interesting to hear what you think is doing.
It must be because of using the left and right sides of the brain, mustn't it? I'm amazed because I was an art teacher. I had to teach pottery. I never got on very well with it. And I struggle with clay. And you watch them. We've got a 92-year-old who loves making coil pots.
I think it's also to do with muscle memory, observing how people have come to the session. So we have one participant who, from the whole time we've known her, she's been mostly non-verbal. She only kind of says a few words at a time. But coming back into the studio, if she hadn't been in for a while, you got this sense that she recognised where she was and who she was with, and she'd have this huge smile spread across her face, and then she'd sort of come to the table and pick up the rolling pin and just start rolling it, and there wouldn't be any clay there. There are lots of skills in clay that, and some of the participants have talked about this as well, that do relate to things like cooking or things they might have done in their past life. So one of our participants who has absolutely loved clay used to be a chef. So that kind of similar motor skills and that attention to detail, I think there are connections there. And the participant that Janine was talking about who loves making coil pots, when she first came, she made lots and lots of clay roses. And her daughter who comes with her said that that was from when she used to decorate pies, and she would make flowers out of pastry to decorate the pie. So I think there is that connection to the sort of motor skills that they would have done in the past. And I wonder if that helps that progression as well, or if it's just that it is such a tactile material.
Speaking to Helen Lee again, she can back this up for us with some light brain science.
There was a surgeon recently who came out to say his students were struggling because none of them learn how to make things as children. So their fingers aren't manipulative enough to sew when they're sewing up their patients.
Yeah, Roger Kneebone, who's been doing an awful lot of research on craft and the loss of craft skills in surgery, basically.
Yeah, I know some of them in the early days of surgery, they used to go to seamstresses and learn all the different stitches. I love that thought, that they sought that knowledge out. Teach me a stitch that will do this, and train me in that skill. And also that we develop just as our brains change depending on our context. I think there's a sort of event horizon for language. If you don't learn it by a certain age, it's very difficult to learn language. And that's true of our whole network. So if you learn dexterity at a young age, it's going to be very different to the dexterity you learn. Well, you're never going to have that command that you would have if you'd learned it very young. That's just a window that's going to have been lost.
So that's interesting. There's another thing that Katie mentioned, that she was thinking that maybe, which I hope this isn't the case, because if it is, I think it means that what we're talking about has quite a kind of finite sort of generational thing happening. Because she was saying that a lot of her dementia patients, like one of them had been a cook, or had been a mother who like made pastry, or had been an engineer or something like that. So these people had quite a lot of hand skill already, which meant that when what was happening and what was kind of firing was kind of forgotten or kind of inherent sort of bodily understanding.
Yes, deep, exactly. And the older those memories are, the more intact they are.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously, if we're talking about the generation now, when I'm probably the only person, even in my generation, who's ever made pastry when they were a kid, you know, like, people don't do it anymore. I had a very kind of crafty upbringing, you know, everyone was making jam and doing all sorts of whatever, you know, it was just one of those sort of families. But so many people don't have that now. Do you think there is something there, or do you think that these kind of practices of making with your hands are just something that's just good to do anyway?
I think it's good to do anyway. I think it's a very deep instinctive thing. Going back to that thing I always bang on about the 10,000 nerve endings in each fingertip and an almost infinite number of receptor brain cells over the top, I'm going to have more of those because I learned craft at an early age. But that's not to say that someone who hasn't done that is, they're still wired up and their hands are still tool-making hands. And the more they do it, the more dexterous they become. They won't have the skill that someone who's learned it at a very early age will. But that, I don't think that matters a jot. It matters in the sense that there's a certain amount of stimulation that will be lost. So the people who are bringing back old skills, that will be helping them more, no doubt about it. Because they will have built bigger areas of the brain, and we've got to mitigate that. But we're also a generation now, people exercise more. I don't think my parents ever exercised particularly. And I think we're more aware of what we eat. And so there are different things that people are good at maybe that will help. But it will be interesting to see how that pans out, because it is very different not having those craft skills.
Yeah, like maybe even just sort of like motor skills. Like, I wonder whether it's sort of, you know, you'll kind of get people coming up to clay and kind of tapping on it like a keyboard or something. But I mean, that's a whole sort of other thing to think about.
It is. It's very much for education to look at and say, what skills do we want to cultivate? Do we want to be crafters, or do we just want to be screen lookers?
And on the notion that Katie and Janine seem to witness, that we can continue to learn even as our brains sustain damage.
Bringing it more back to your sort of observations of working with people with dementia and clay. And having spoken to Katie and Janine, who are doing a similar kind of project at the Garden Museum, Katie's absolutely convinced that it's what she's seeing is that people are actually learning and retaining information. I just wondered what you thought about that, or if you had any kind of science, like kind of hypothesis science behind it, because obviously in dementia, the entire point of it is, the entire symptom of it is that it disconnects. And that you can't reconnect, you know, it's kind of slowly shutting things down, isn't it? Rather than kind of actually allowing you to create new information.
Yeah, I think shutting it down is an interesting expression, because that's kind of a metaphor. What's actually happening is areas are being killed off, but the capacity of the brain to build is not affected, if that makes sense. So you can be building neurons and connections all the time whilst over there something's dying, right? So the damage is not everywhere, and it's not shutting things down. It's in vascular, for example, the blood flow is restricted. So on a day-to-day basis, it will affect different areas in different ways. But as long as there's blood there, the brain will always be building and connecting. So if there's damage over there, that doesn't mean to say you're not going to build. And if you think of the size of the thing, so what is it? Endless billions of connections and trillions of neurons, or, you know, it's so massive. And the other thing that I think been quite interesting for me to reflect on is dementia is obviously going on a heck of a long time before we're aware of it. Not in all cases, but in a lot of cases. The brain can sustain masses of damage before you even notice, because it's so massive. And also, I think the brain, because it's driven by connection, it's permanently rewiring. So what you observe with people with dementia is one day they will be, you can almost see the damage. And if you're right-handed, there's less damage than if you're left-handed, because there's more networking on the side that you're connected to. So the damage is less obvious on one side than the other. So there can be days where the damage looks quite tangible and something very specific gets lost. And you see that on a daily basis, that loss. But at the same time, experiences and things are building the whole time. And so the more you can have those new experiences, obviously you've not got to calibrate that and it's still a one-way path, but the more you can be building while that damage is happening, the longer you're putting off the damage or the more you're compensating. I mean, the other thing to think about going back to clay is concentrating on where the brain is less damaged versus where it's more damaged. So the outer reaches of the brain are likely to be more damaged because as things are cut, the things that are furthest away from the blood and the things that are sort of at the outer reaches are going to be damaged more.
Like frostbite.
Exactly. And that's where we do our conceptual thinking, right? So time very quickly becomes very difficult to get one's head around. It's a concept. Time doesn't exist. We assume it exists, but it's just an abstract concept, as is most of the digital world. So that is just a nightmare when you've got dementia. What's really heartbreaking is you lose a shared reality at that level when you're with someone with dementia, because you can't talk about tomorrow. You can't talk about, you know, shall we do this? But if I'm sitting next to you making a pot, and I would actually say that that's interesting, you can face something, and that's quite aggressive, right? You're in a group and you're sitting next to someone. That's totally shared reality. That's not abstract. That's a real solid thing. And there is nothing more solid than clay, not least because when you fire it, boy, is it solid. And also the metaphor, I think, the clay, that's very moving and very powerful. You are making something timeless and time is disappearing.
Yeah. And it holds that time. It manifests it because you can see very physically and in a very linear way, like the thing being formed.
Yes. Yes, it has a beginning, middle and end.
You can see where you've been.
Well, absolutely, and that calibrates time in a non-abstract sense.
You can kind of talk a bit about the sort of clay side of things as well, because there's obviously the neurology of it, which I just think is absolutely fascinating. But equally, just that idea that it's creating a community space. Could you maybe talk a little bit about that in terms of the sort of importance of kind of coming together to collectively do something?
Well, I think what dementia highlights is the context of a loss of purpose. And what that group collective bonding is doing is creating purpose. There's a purpose, a meaning, there's a story, and there's a belonging. And all that absolutely goes into the group. There's a sort of medicalizing of everything. We sort of think that an intervention has to be medicalized. And one of the things you learn as a therapist, you have to learn very quickly, is A, you mustn't therap anybody who isn't a client. And B, I'm very much of the camp of not analysing. And, you know, when I was working with the Wednesday Wanderers, I don't think any of them knew I had been a psychotherapist. And that wasn't what I was doing there at all. I was a pottery teacher. That's more than enough. You know, the therapy is the context and the pots. That's the bottom line for a human, that we're part of a community and we need to find a way to facilitate that on the ground. I mean, it's lovely that the GPs are social prescribing a bit now. So you can be prescribed an allotment or, the Wednesday Wanderers is something that the GP is connected to and can refer people to. It just needs much more, you know, funding. And it's interesting that it so relies on volunteers. And that's the scary thing, particularly for people in craft, that you're meant to turn up unpaid with all these skills and help people learn to carve spoons or make pots or whatever. Not everyone's in that position. And actually, it would be a really good way of sponsoring people to have good careers in craft, which is very tough. And just as they teach for money, to be sort of a facilitator of these things would be a huge resource that would be very financially supportive of the art community and also would be a very efficient way of reaching a lot of people who need these skills.
As I pointed out, everyone in this episode is primarily an artist, not a neurologist or even a social worker per se. But in my mind, there seems to be a woeful separation between our medical and social care that, with a bit more linked-up thinking, might not only create jobs for artists, but also have a huge impact on how we care for people in our society at large. Both 15 Days and the Wednesday Wanderers are NHS prescribed, which essentially means that the NHS has now started prescribing clay workshops and walking groups instead of drugs. Just to be clear, just as clay can't cure dementia, I'm not saying that it should replace modern medicine. But everyone I've spoken to has seen these groups have a huge impact on the quality of life of the participants and their families. Jana has worked closely with social services for the whole 17 years of her career with 15 Days, but the age-old issue of how to fund this kind of work, which sits in the grey intersection between art, teaching and social or medical care, has been something she constantly battles with.
It's so obvious the kind of benefit that these spaces and this kind of engagement has for people across the board, regardless of whether you've got a disability or not, but especially I think for people with learning difficulties or whatever it might be, it has huge benefits, but it's very difficult, or seems to be very difficult still, to quantify that in a way that people will listen to. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the kind of challenges you've had with that, especially in terms of funding. You know, I always think I must be really boring talking about how do people get money, but I think it's such an important one to understand how these spaces where it's not a business model, you know, you're talking about sustainability, like how you sustain yourself and how you convince people that actually, no, it does work, it is worthy.
I think it's taken many, many years and many, many fights to get the recognition. And the way that I think we've done that is through exhibitions, really, has been a main way. Because, you know, obviously when you've got an exhibition, and all our exhibitions are really professionally done, you know, and like when the guys make their work, finishes everything. So this is a proper show. We are going to do it to absolute high end here. And I think that people suddenly go, oh, okay, this work is, you know, this is really good. Mm. What you're doing is really good. And then we also did, I offered through the local adult ed, I offered qualifications, so recognised qualifications. So NCFE Creative Craft Level 1, Level 2. Several of the artists got Arts Council funding. So it's kind of building up, playing the politician, which is what I'm quite good at. We have the Queen's Consort, who is now open to all our shows, and he is just the most remarkable, wonderful, amazing man. So we have, you know, connections to royalty that we call him our mascot. Again, I think, you know, when you see the work, it kind of speaks for itself and you can't argue. We've been here for 17 years. I've still got people that have been with me since the start. So that speaks for itself as well. So when people come, they tend to stay. And that was another thing, having to fight with funders effectively to say, look, we all know as being artists, you can't just suddenly say, right, okay, here's funding for 3 months. And then that's it. You must be creative by now. Thank you. Bye. Move on. So I've had to fight and say, look, this is a continual process. If somebody wants to come with me for the whole of this journey, brilliant, they can. So that's, you know, now that's in place because we're constantly learning. I'm still learning. So I think as far as the funding goes now, what I've actually done is I'm actually not a charity. So I'm a sole trader. So basically, as far as getting funding, a lot of the time I can't get it because I don't qualify. So everybody that comes to me either self-funds or uses direct payments, that, you know, their personal independent budgets to pay. And I have in the past managed to secure some funding to set up new days. But this kind of is a double-edged sword in a lot of ways, especially obviously now with what's going on with COVID. It's a very uncertain time. So it's kind of, should I set up as a social enterprise, charity? These are things that I'm currently looking at. Because obviously I want 15 days to carry on and survive. That's primarily what's really important. And I think it's that whole aspect of if you are a charity or social enterprise, you can access pots of money, which will enable new groups to attend. So this is where it becomes kind of sort of tricky. So, I mean, for me personally at this stage, these are decisions that I'm currently thinking about. How do we evolve? Mm-hmm. How does this survive? You know, it'd be great to be able to get funding to bring other artists in. So it's kind of like, how big do you want to grow this?
Yeah.
Really will sort of determine, you know, the funding stream that you go to. Because we've been around for so long, as far as sort of social services go, I've got a great relationship with them. So they know who we are. They know what we offer. It's very respected in Dorset.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's like life is far easier in some ways now than it was. I think before when I first started, I was going around to so many different organizations. Hello, this is me doing PowerPoints, offering free taster sessions constantly. It was what's next, what's next, what's next. It was draining. So I think what's nice now is the kind of pressure's off to a degree because the reputation is there, but it's what's next, what's next. I think the worrying thing is, from a financial level, is that things are always being cut. It's a constant kind of, okay, Or, you know, suddenly we had a few years ago, social services weren't going to then fund people with a moderate to mild learning disability. So they got the funding slashed. So I lost a lot of people. And it was like, ah, it's a ridiculous thing, because what you're actually doing is stopping those people from accessing activities. So they're going to deteriorate. It's almost like you're willing them to deteriorate. So they go to the next tier. Right. Oh, now you can have some funding. Whereas actually it's far better to keep that person, you know, improving and having options. And, you know, it's a very frustrating world.
It's kind of a running theme that proving the value of these creative interactions in community ceramics, this relational way of approaching dementia care or mental health or neurodivergence, is one of the main challenges facing these kinds of projects and spaces. The results and benefits can't be quantified on a spreadsheet of progress statistics, because many of the issues that face Jana, Katie's, Bridget's and Helen's students aren't going to get better. But all of the artists I spoke to, some of which have decades of experience working in this way, came to the same conclusion and witnessed the same result over and over, that clay creates a space for community and care and much needed supplementary support for medical services that's needed now more than ever.
I realise I've built up an incredible amount of knowledge and ways of teaching. And I think when you're able to reach somebody, when I teach, I do like make noises to get people to understand. Because sometimes people, you know, maybe don't understand certain ways of teaching. So I'll have noises, or I'll relate it to sort of, you know, if they're handling clay, imagine it's a baby kitten. So you can understand that. So you're like gently stroking and rhythm. Which works really, really well. I personally would love to sort of be involved in research of just the benefits of clay, especially things like working with, you know, people with dementia. I've been working with people, there was spinal injury units. And again, oh my God, the people come in and they don't even realize they've just done a big rehab session. And I was working with physios, OTs, which was great. So you've got that medical side going, oh my goodness, you know, that person has just done da 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 da. And I'm like, yes, well, I knew they were, but now I've got you to say, because you know your side, and you can say, yes.
In the next episode, we're going even further into clay as an identity building tool, meeting projects run by previously incarcerated.